Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us in our studio, Lauren Davis. I'm glad that you're here, and I want to read your bio so people know a little bit more about you. Lauren Davis is the author of Each Wild Thing's Consent, available from Poetry Wolf Press. She holds an MFA from the Bennington College Writing Seminars. Davis works as an editor at the Tishman Review and teaches and works at the Writers' Workshop and Imprint Books here in Port Townsend. She is a former editor in residence at the Puritan's Town Crier and has been awarded a residency at Hypatia in the Woods. Her poetry, essays, stories, and fairy tales can be found in publications such as Prairie Schooner, Automata Review, Empty Mirror, and Gingerbread House Literary Magazine. Welcome again to the program, Lauren.
Thank you, Sheila. It's great to be here.
I've seen you so often at the bookstore and talked with you, and now I'm excited to talk with you more about your poetry and other genres that you write in. So let's start by me asking you how you came to come to Port Townsend.
It's a little bit of a convoluted story. I got lost in the rainforest. I was on a road trip around the country. It was about 16,000 miles. I was hitting the four corners of the United States. And I was hunting mushrooms with a group and got lost, and I was not the only one lost. So the other so-called survivor that got out, we had a conversation. And I told him about my trip, and he told me that Copper Canyon was up in Port Townsend because he found out that I was a poet. And Copper Canyon is absolutely one of my favorite presses, so I had to come. And I drove into Port Townsend and was just in love. How could you not be in love? And it felt like home. It just felt like home. And I continued on my trip, and I finished up, and I was living in Vermont at the time. So I went back there and I packed up my things and moved in the middle of winter, which I don't recommend driving across the country in the middle of winter, but I made it. Port Townsend was calling. So wow. Now I'm home.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. As an ambitious road trip you were taking.
Quite so, yes.
And so why did you, or how did you design the idea that you wanted to see the four corners of the country?
That's a great question. I read on the road as an adolescent, and you get that fever. And I had it for a very long time, and I just wanted to see this country. I grew up in the south of the United States, where everything is quite small. It's very flat. We have hills. And I just wanted to see the rest of the world. So I figured I would start.
I got lost in the rainforest. Sounds like the beginning of one of your fairy tales.
Right.
Poetry Wolf Press describes your chapbook, Each Wild Thing's Consent, as 24 pages, and you, I think, along with the press, have decided that partial proceeds go to the local Jefferson County nonprofit called the Duff House, which is here in Port Townsend. So before we talk about your book and its content and hear you read from it, could you tell us a little bit about Gray Wolf, how it felt to publish with them, and the decision to donate funds to the Duff House?
So Dove House does such important work. Violence is a part of our society. Unfortunately, we're all affected by it, whether it's direct or indirectly. So having an organization like that here is such a gift to us. They do counseling. They do legal work, pro bono. It's absolutely vital for a community to have something like that, I think, in order to heal, to start that process. And so I was really honored that I got to make that decision. And that's one of the things that drew me to Poetry Wolf Press, was this ability to choose the nonprofit.
So that's part of their publishing process.
It is.
That is wonderful.
It is.
And where are they located?
Kentucky.
Uh-huh. What a good idea.
Yeah.
Was it a good process publishing the book?
It was. It was definitely a learning process. It was my first chapbook. And so I learned a lot about myself, and I grew pretty close to the publisher also. We both learned a lot about ourselves. So we took the journey together, mm-hmm. and it was a great process.
So what sort of thing did you learn?
I learned what I really wanted my chapbook to communicate. Before I had it in my hands and before I started really working on it, it felt like a dream. And then it started to become reality, and I said, what do I want this to do? You know, and I had to really wrestle with that.
That is really interesting, because I'm going to read from what a reviewer said about your book in an online reviewing magazine called Panoply Zine. And it's funny when you, these screen names, you never know exactly how to say
right.
them. We'll tell the listeners after I read this what a chapbook is by definition. In her effort to describe the feminine divine, Davis shows us that in sharing, after earning consent, we make spiritual connections and reach plateaus we could not make or reach alone. A good chapbook follows a theme. A great one delivers that theme in all its multifaceted roundness. It echoes and reverberates, reveals the depth of the theme, sometimes linearly, sometimes discursively. Windblown references uncover the hidden, and so it is with each wild thing's consent. The theme develops organically, beginning with physical love and sensual stimulations. As a poet creating book-length volumes, I haven't really thought about theme so much as just what reads well as you move along in the book, which is maybe related to theme. But my understanding of a poet's work is that they've worked over this many years since their last book, and it's time to publish their poems again. And this idea that a chapbook, which is smaller, so I'll let you define mm-hmm. that, has a theme is really interesting to me. So let's talk about that.
So I'm a bit obsessive by nature, and the chapbook is the perfect format for that because I really get to dive in with a theme and obsess about it and really cultivate a voice that's strong throughout. Or that's my hope, at least. So I actually created the chapbook in sort of a backwards manner. I was working on a full length, and then I realized that some of these poems spoke to each other, and I realized they wanted to live with each other. So that's how it came about.
So did you go looking for a chapbook publisher in particular?
I did. I put the full length aside for a while, and I said, this is what I want out there right now. This is the message that I want to communicate.
And as you were working with the publisher, did you find that she read it differently and had a different order, things like that? Or did they stay the same way as you liked them?
They stayed the same. There's actually no change in order. There was a little bit of editing, which was a great process to go through. But beyond that, it stayed the same.
Thank you for mentioning editing. I do a lot of teaching, and people are like, is this still my poem? If you have this editorial idea of changing lines around or deleting some or taking some words away or questioning a choice of word. And I always say, yes, of course. These are your words. An editor is a useful tool, a useful adjunct to writing. Only editors don't get seen.
Correct, right? Yes.
So we think that all the published poets we're reading wrote them that way with no editorial advice. Mm-hmm. And it's really good to, I think, to acknowledge that we're in this together, and to get our unconscious to speak clearly through our conscious self on the page sometimes requires a listener, an acute listener, mm-hmm. who can help us.
Absolutely. I need editors. I need first readers. I need a community. I get stuck in my head, and I think I've communicated something, and I haven't, and I need to hear that, absolutely.
I guess before we go further, diving into this conversation, we should define a chapbook. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about how you see that?
So a chapbook is basically a smaller book, and it's usually limited edition. It's often handmade, but those aren't requirements. Really, it's about length, and often there's a theme that's stronger throughout, but that's not true either. So really, it's about how long it is.
Right. So I was taught that the name chapbook comes from when the printing press was first made in England. Booksellers would be men in big overcoats with pockets on the insides, and they would call out cheap books with their, and open their jacket or they mean their coat, and that sounded it with an English accent, like chap books. I don't know if you've heard that.
I haven't heard that. I heard that there were chap men who would go around with their wagons and sell things like bits of string. And then that's how communities got their news, was through these chap books. So I guess there's a bit of mythology behind where the origin is. Uh-huh. I love that.
But yours was in England too. It sounds like your story.
Correct, yes.
Yeah. And maybe one led to the other.
Correct.
One way or the other. So getting back to the work, would you like to read to us?
I would love that. So this is Native from Each Wild Thing's Consent. Remember us in our big red truck, vacationing along the Quinault Lake Loop, frightening the foliage from its sleep. Roofed by dank rainforest, we knew we were not alone, though we saw no bird, no beast. You said it's beautiful, but do we really belong here where creatures hide? Then an elk herd stomped across the dirt road and you braked, shocked. The fattest turned to stare over his long beard, to know or warn us. Yes, my love, we belong, but on soil-stained knees, asking for each wild thing's consent to stand.
That is beautiful.
Thank you.
And it's coming on a day when, unhappily, I heard the news, all over the news, that humans are ruining nature and about extinctions and that we could do something about it. So it's a very important poem as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
I love the idea of the sanctity of nature and that we're only one part of it, and it's by their consent that we're here.
Right.
How humble. And another one?
Absolutely. Mountain Incidental. I would, if I could, bed you now, but the birch trees, if you had seen how they stand side by side like rude revenants, you'd know. They nearly informed of other worlds. I am without fault, my car in the ditch. The ice appeared beyond a bend, the elevation felt minor. Have faith, I am only temporarily mislaid. I tread down the mountainside in the rain.
That's a very uplifting poem, I think. I'm only temporarily mislaid. Very sweet.
I didn't know that you couldn't just drive into the mountains during winter here. Coming from the south, I didn't realize it wasn't safe.
And you ran into ice.
I learned my lesson.
You also got a beautiful poem.
That's correct, yes.
Yes, thank you. And I think you've selected a third one to read to us.
Yes. But most of all, beloved, never, not ever will I braid your absence through my hair. I will not accept the single-bodied bed. I hear you in the ceiling, your breath fogs the dark. Why did I come here where your body could not go? Remember when I brought you to the woods to show you my owls, how quickly they greeted you, coiling down from the trees before we even turned the trail. How small is my heart that I felt jealousy then. Each day I leave the cabin and wait for the orcas off-season. Madronas undress their lairs so that I might gaze a little longer. I keep a piece of fossilized wood that matches yours. I hold it to my lips. But most of all, I am a woman in communion, her ear to the wall.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Sheila is talking with Port Townsend poet Lauren Davis about her new poetry chapbook and her work in the literary hub of Port Townsend.
Certainly in praise of the place you call home.
Yes.
Very lucky to have been able to be there and see all that. I love the person-to-person feeling between you and nature, like the Madrona trees undressing so that you can gaze longer.
They're so beautiful.
It's a delicate thing in all writing, personification, but you do it in such a beautiful way in that poem so that you're not really personifying the tree so much as being grateful to what is in the natural course of their cycle.
It's hard not to praise them.
They're interesting trees, aren't they? Do you want to talk any more about theme, about how these poems spoke to each other now that we've heard a few?
Well, I was looking for a narrative arc. I didn't want it to be too tight. So that was an interesting thing to try to put together, since what looks like a narrative arc in the chapbook isn't actually true to life as far as what happened day by day. I think it's really important as poets that we allow ourselves to stretch the truth a little bit and to tell the emotional truth, but not always the factual truth.
Mm-hmm. You said that the poems spoke to each other and wanted to live together in the same book. But they had a way, and their conversation together was maybe different than the chronological order of writing them.
Correct.
And where they take place.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We learn so much by writing poetry.
It's
an amazing thing. And I think that true wisdom doesn't come in a linear fashion.
No. I wish it did.
I don't know. When you're a poet, it's really interesting to figure that out. Like that, as my teachers would say, the words are smarter than I am.
Mm.
And sometimes they're smarter about things that you're going to catch up with in the future.
Right.
Right. But then when you see a mass of them, you go, oh, yeah, I kind of already knew that, even though I didn't know I knew that. So thank you. But you also write in other genres. And that list of the other genres was quite amazing, including fairy tales. So how did you come to the other genres? Were they first? Was poetry first?
So poetry has always been my first love. So it's actually interesting. The shift to prose happened very recently. So I went to the South Carolina Governor's School for the Arts Humanity for high school, which was a 2-year program. So it was 4 hours every day of writing. So I was formally taught in all genres, playwriting, editing, Chicago manual style. So I had the basics, but I always loved poetry and was scared of prose. It was actually this last winter, I threw up my hands. I had been working so hard on the full-length manuscript, it no longer felt joyful. And I said, if I write one more couplet, I'm going to scream. I needed a break. I needed to make it an experiment. I need to create play again in my writing. So I started to give myself assignments. Flash fiction was one of them. And this interesting thing started to happen when I was writing flash fiction. All my female characters were profoundly isolated, I found. And I grew up in southern suburbia, surrounded by community, but because of certain circumstances, very lonely and very isolated. And I found that flash fiction and essays were giving me a place to talk about that grief in a way that poetry hadn't. I had tried to explore that before in poetry, and it wasn't happening for me. And so it was really a gift to dive into other genres.
And it happened here while living in Port Townsend.
It did, yes. Yeah.
So I know that you have an excerpt or maybe a whole story to read to us.
This is All Our Little Ones, published in Ottawa Review. The children drowned on a Sunday, 3 of them, all newborns. The rest of the deaths came the Sundays after. It took us all a while to figure out the cause of death, since none of them were around water when they drowned, except Tony taking a bath. The others, though, they were sleeping or up in sycamores or sitting at their cramped kindergarten craft tables. Sally Starr was making a mud pie, George Thompson a valentine. By the time the FBI got involved, we had lost 20 babies and toddlers. We didn't talk of it at the time, but there were 15 miscarriages, too. The real number is probably higher, but who wants to share these things? My grief couldn't catch up with me. Still hasn't. I went hard as rime ice. They had lots of questions for everyone. The agents scribbled a lot of stuff down, stared at everyone a real long time if they stumbled on their words. And of course the press made they all rot in hell, even the sound guys. My brother-in-law tried to explain it to me, how they knew it was drowning. He talked about water in the stomach and bloody froth in the airways. I got up and filled a glass from the kitchen sink and walked out the room. I opened the sliding glass doors to the backyard and left right into the woods in my slippers. There were a lot of women like me, going around in pajamas and unmade faces, still are. New footpaths have formed in the forest from our wandering. I didn't have a child to lose. My one son, Cal, was 19 and at seminary, 3 hours and 15 minutes from my doorstep. Even then, I worried for him. I ran my fingers over his daddy's urn and prayed. My Cal, his first word love, first steps into my arms. All his years, one single tussle over a friend's honor during an away game. A damn good man, that's what they say. And then there were no more drownings. Within the year, the FBI packed up, the press left. They called it bad forensics. A virus had run its course. Not a drowned child in the ground, save little Tony, they said. But we knew the truth. There were no more children to lose. And why was it here? Could have been the water, could have been the soil. But we are a fine town. We take care of each other. You've never seen a DMV line move with such finesse, jelly candies and cookies on each counter. Never seen cows so tranquil munching their miles of bright green grass. Even through the drownings, we didn't gossip. We kept our doors unlocked. A lesser town would have torched itself in a fistful of days. The knock came on a Sunday evening. I recognize my neighbor's knocks. Miss Gladys has a real soft one, 3 taps. Frank's is a persistent bang like a mechanical hammer. The UPS woman, 2 hard raps. This knock, though, I hadn't heard before. Miss Smith, the man said, his hands grasped behind him when I answered the door. I saw the dullness of his suit, his skin as pale as a newborn's. May he never forgive me. I slapped him. He didn't even flinch. Miss Smith, he repeated, cleared his throat. May we come in? My name is Richard from Roanoke Seminary, and this is Father Arnold. Behind Richard stood a chaplain with a turned face. I stepped aside. Cal had drowned in his bed. There was an investigation. They didn't understand yet, but they would soon. But I knew what happened.
Hmm. These are the first two pages?
Correct,
and
yes.
How many more pages are there?
Two more.
Oh, it's a very chilling story. And you really do a good job of the fictional dream so that I feel like I'm in that town with that speaker and worried about, you know, from the time you plant the, but my son was 19 and he was away. And then you think, yeah, maybe it's just going on this town. Oh, it's a virus. And then whoops, the thing that you worried about has come, as a listener, has come true.
Right.
So thank you for leaving us there. And now we're all going to want to read your story. It's in
Automata Review.
Okay. And people can find it, and they can maybe find a link to it on your website.
That's correct,
which is
yes.
Lauren Davis.
LaurenDavisPoetry.com.
Good. Lauren Davis Poetry, but it includes prose, too. My very first poetry class was with the poet David Wagner, and one among the many memorable things he said is that if you are a poet, you must always learn to write in another genre.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
And he said there are times when the poems won't come.
It's true.
You've experienced it, I have, and I bet a lot of poets have. And what you said about poetry being scary, one of my classmates in that class said she felt that whole sentences were frightening because she was, not that poets don't write in whole sentences, but she didn't see it that way because of line breaks. Mm-hmm. And one sentence going on and just having the margins as your parameters rather than sound was frightening to her.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So here you are working and teaching in one of the literary hubs of Port Townsend. Copper Canyon attracted you here. Mm-hmm. And now that you are here, you're working for one of the other distinguished hubs. What's that feel like?
Oh, it's wonderful. So Anna and Peter Quinn are the co-owners of Imprint Books, the Writers Workshop and Imprint Books. And they have created such a supportive environment for writers and readers here, both. They actually just rearranged the stores so the Port Townsend authors are in the front, which is really exciting to walk in and see how much talent we have here. It's amazing. And the workshops that they facilitate and the writers that they bring in, I think have really been a gift for everybody. Definitely. I've seen so many people from their first draft all the way to publication really blossom under their guidance.
That's exciting.
It is.
So that's one of the most exciting.
Absolutely.
To see that development and growth.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So what about being the bookstore seller, which you are when you're not teaching, and you're advising people on books, you're watching them browse, you're listening to their opinions. Any insights from that?
For me, it's not that much different from facilitating a workshop. It's one of those things where I have to let go of my opinions and really help the other person. So my taste is not relevant. You know, it's actually about what they need and right. what they want.
So if they want a mystery thriller, you can advise them.
I'm going to find it for them, yes.
Excellent. How much fun. Does it ever expand your own reading?
It does. You know, I didn't read children's books at all until I started working at the bookstore, and they are so delightful. I've been missing out all these years.
So that's exciting. It's a two-way street.
Absolutely.
That's great. So you're teaching and you're writing and you're helping readers. Does that all combine in some way into your writing life?
It does. They're all different skill sets that I've had to cultivate and work on. But the things that make each thing safe, creating a safe workshop environment, supporting readers, holding boundaries for myself, for my writing, all those things really speak to each other. That place where I have to force myself to get out of my comfort zone, I have to do that in all of those areas too. So they all help.
As did a trip to the four corners of the country.
Correct, yes.
And surviving getting lost. So it sounds to me like you're striving in many ways to push yourself into maybe hopefully only slightly uncomfortable places so that your true voice comes out.
I'm only growing if I'm uncomfortable.
Uh-huh. Tough lesson, but a good one. Yeah. So what are your biggest obstacles to your writing?
So there have been two huge ones, and one I've learned to work with over the past few years, relatively recently. I got my MFA and nothing was happening for me. I would send out a poem here or there and get the inevitable rejection and say, what now? I was really distraught. And so I decided that I wanted to invite rejection in. I wanted to make a place for it at the table. So I started to set rejection goals, and that allowed me to take more chances and to put myself out there more and to play and experiment. And that's been a huge gift. It doesn't mean that rejection doesn't hurt any less. I, you know, I definitely have to sit mm-hmm. there and feel those feelings when that no mm-hmm. arrives. But things have definitely changed for me now. And another thing that I really struggle with is that idea of a daily writing practice. It's just not how I operate in the world. And I have no doubt that creating a daily practice makes a strong writer. There's no doubt about that. I'm not capable of doing that. I've tried, and it's created shame and frustration. So I've learned to work with my own personality. I kind of like to think of it like the Pacific Northwest rain. Like, writing is always there, but it's sometimes on a break. So, but every day I'm showing up to the writing life. I'm helping other writers, or I'm editing, or I'm reading. So in some way, every day, I'm showing up for that. But it's not always pen to paper.
So when do you write? What makes you clear that space?
Well, sometimes it's there and it's persistent uh-huh. and it wants to be written. Uh-huh. And sometimes if a couple of weeks have gone by uh-huh. and nothing has happened, then I give myself an assignment. I play teacher.
Ah, okay. And you do teach and you also edit. So if people go to your website, Lauren Davis, and I'm going to spell it LaurenDavisPoetry.com, they're going to see your offerings.
Correct, yes.
Right. Excellent. We don't often think about poetry needing editing, but it's a way of developing the poem to its fullest manifestation. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I think is true, that when you do that kind of work, you're always using that gratifying poetry writing brain. And sometimes that, for me, it keeps me from writing because I'm already satisfied. But knowing your own rhythm seems like very good advice mm-hmm. to people, and not shaming, use the word shaming, not shaming yourself for not being that disciplined writer who gets up at 5 every morning and writes for 3 hours before anything else right. happens. Some of us spend time taking in and being in the temporal world, and then if we're lucky, the muse comes by and we get into the non-temporal world, and it's so much fun.
It is. Yeah.
And I hope that you still get time to go out into nature and get that inspiration that comes.
Yes, I live in the woods, basically. There are trees all around us. And it's...
Is that where your owls live?
No, those are at Fort Worden, so I have to go visit them.
That's not very far away.
It's not.
That's excellent. It's been a pleasure to talk with you this morning.
Thank you. This has been wonderful.
And I love your poems. And people can find your book sitting in the front of the bookstore with all the PT writers?
They can.
Excellent. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you, Sheila.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.